Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, my name is Sarah, and I'll be your host for this episode of the New Books Network. We are here with William Duffy, an associate professor and coordinator of writing, rhetoric, and technical communications at the University of Memphis, to chat about his book, Beyond Conversation, Collaboration and the Production of Writing, which, as a writer and editor myself, surprisingly not terribly versed in writing philosophy for some reason, gave me lots of insights, so I'm excited to dive in. So to start, could you maybe introduce yourself a little bit more and sort of describe your motivations for this book?
Sure. As you mentioned, I'm an associate professor at the University of Memphis. For the last 3 years, I served as the coordinator of writing, rhetoric, and tech comm here. I actually, this fall, I'm moving into a new role. I'm the director of graduate studies in the department. This is my eighth year here at the University of Memphis. And this project originally started as a dissertation in which I was primarily interested in researching the history of collaborative writing theory, because in graduate school, if you pursue writing studies or rhetoric and composition, which is my field, it's fairly common that you're going to read a handful of texts that focus on the social turn in the social sciences and how that influenced collaborative learning theory. And by the time I was in graduate school, it just was sort of an assumption that collaboration is good. There's really nothing bad that we can say about it. And here are, you know, the three or four articles or books that you should read so that you know that this was one time an issue of debate, and let's move on. And a lot of that stuff was really dated by the time I got to graduate school. And just by a sheer dumb luck, I fell into an opportunity to co-author something with a friend of mine. And I found the experience not only invigorating and exciting, but I also noticed how different it was from what I assumed it would be based on what I had read about it. And so I wrote this dissertation really just as an attempt to kind of come to terms with where the status of collaboration is sort of a critical concept in the humanities, especially where it was currently. And then kind of set the project aside until I got here to the University of Memphis, where I was teaching graduate students on a regular basis. And I realized that this was and I was writing a lot more with others, and I realized that I wanted to return to this project. And so I kind of started from scratch, and here's where we are now with this book.
Nice. I guess I'm curious, like, what were some of the misconceptions or the limitations of, like, the previous theories some of the older theories?
Yeah. So primarily, I would say that there were two concepts that really dominated how, and I think still dominate how a lot of graduate students in communication programs and English and writing and rhetoric programs, how they're oriented to the work of collaboration as sort of a critical idea. The first one is that collaboration is like that idea of like the turtle all the way down in space. Like, it's just everything is collaborative. And so, like, the first chapter of my book the title is Ask a Question, like, is all writing collaborative? Because that's what we were taught originally. And that's what a lot of that sort of early theory in the late 80s and 90s kind of propagated, is this idea that because of the social turn, this idea of discourse communities and whatnot, all writing a social through and through. And then somehow we went from all writing a social to all writing is thus collaborative, which, I mean, you know, it's a pithy claim. But in practice, I really didn't know what difference that claim made, because on the one hand, if all writing is collaborative, then why do we even collaborate in the first place? Why do we even aspire to teach students to co-author if it makes no qualitative difference whatsoever to how we understand what the product of that writing is and where it comes from? The other reason is that I think it like kind of occludes actual collaborative writers. You know, if you say all writing is collaborative, then what makes people who actually write collaboratively, what makes their work special or different? So that's the first idea that I was questioning. The second idea really sort of stemmed from where a lot of that debate in the 80s and 90s focused when scholars were talking about collaborative learning. And that is sort of the role of conflict and consensus. So where there was pushback, and I think some of it was fair, it was in this idea that collaboration can promote groupthink especially in context of, let's say, post-secondary education, at the expense of students' identities and interests and backgrounds and experiences and voices, and which makes a lot of sense, right? Like if you have you know, if you're working on a group project and there's a couple students in that group who come from backgrounds that maybe give them certain advantages and privileges, there's a chance that they're going to drown out the ideas and opinions of their group members. I mean, that idea is why I think so much of us kind of grew up hating group work, especially in college. It's where that idea of like, you know, I hate group work because I'm the one that does all the, you know, all the work, whatever. I think that's where it comes from. But one of the ideas I was kind of pushing back against is that, you know, the primary questions that were leveraged at the idea of collaboration, especially by writing studies theorists, you know, focused on this idea of like, how do we balance the need for consensus alongside the function of conflict? And so I just, you know, I realized that, like, again, you know, certainly some of those questions are important, but at the end of the day, that doesn't really help us understand what collaborative writing entails, especially what that rhetorical labor looks like. Nor does it really underscore the advantages that it offers to writers, especially developing writers. I mean, I get at this, especially if anyone who picks up my book, like all of this kind of grows out of and returns to the task of teaching writing and why so and what sort of we aspire to do as teachers of writing.
Yeah, I definitely the thing I think that was like early on in one of the chapters, you're like, oh, if you don't teach collaboration well, then students are probably going to hate it.
Yes, absolutely.
So it makes me wonder sort of how there's so many things that are going into this, even like even just like 6 minutes into this, it's like a lot of things going on between like the point of collaboration, like collaboration versus community, collaboration versus communication, like sort of teasing apart these differences. But then also on top of that, you have not only like the collaborators, but the thing itself and like sort of like the writing and the what is it objects of discourse sort of having agency within that, but then also somehow turning all of that into a product or something that comes out of that, like what I guess for the one is just like a lot there. I just want to acknowledge that. So it's impressive to just put this into this text, but it also makes you wonder like sort of what processes or what maybe products should be focused on instead, or like what processes would maybe help students learn how to use this process better to like engage and like have those combative ideas and overcome them.
Yeah. So I think this is a good point when I should say, since you've read the book, you know this, but it's worth saying to anyone who's interested in it is that this is very much a book filled with ideas and not necessarily a book filled with practices. It's a book that, you know, my primary audience the primary audience I imagine for the book are graduate students, are faculty who are interested in co-authorship and collaboration, but have a lot of questions or experience or don't have a lot of experiences with it. but also it's for experienced co-authors who have never really been invited or even thought about kind of owning and claiming the processes and all the sort of like the rhetorical ecologies that produce their work. I think, you know, and I talk about this in the introduction to the book, but one of the problems with talking about co-authorship in higher education is that very often it's limited to whatever our disciplines have established in terms of what quote unquote kind of counts, right? And so it's much easier to talk about individual writing as a complex activity than it is collaborative writing, because at the end of the day, right, it's all about whose name goes first, what's your number, how do we account for who did what? In some departments, right, like you're told outright, you know, that collaborative work isn't going to be as valued as much. And so that's why this book is a book of ideas, because really I want to provide a lot of material that co-authors can use to defend and promote their work and what makes it unique. But I will say, when it comes to practices, so last night actually was my first time teaching a face-to-face class since fall 2019. And it's a graduate seminar called Academic Genres and Scholarly Publication. And it's essentially a course, I like to kind of humorously say, it's like the first year writing class for grad students, except we have first semester master students, and as well as students who are wrapping up their coursework and PhD programs. And so we're, you know, I've designed this class as a community of writers. And yesterday I kind of stressed the point that in this class, what really matters is the experience of writing and how we experiment with it. And as I was kind of explaining that to students, to these adults in the classroom, I realized that that's really become my guiding philosophy for every class I teach, whether it's a first year writing class, whether it's a, you know, a technical editing class for undergraduates, or again, like, you know, this grad level publishing class. And so this book really kind of focuses on the importance of leaning into the experience of collaborative writing as such, and trying to garner as much as that as possible. And, you know, I'm very much that instructor who, you know, will give an assignment or a prompt, and when a student raises their hand to say, like, how long should it be? I'm that annoying instructor who says, well, I don't care. Like, I don't know. Like, as long as you should be, right? I'm very allergic to anything that reeks of arbitrary standards or guidelines. I hate with a passion busy work. And I also hate with a passion when you send stuff out for peer review, sometimes people are writing back with really sort of like arbitrary comments that are, you know, that don't make any sense to point out at this stage in the process. And so I think that like, I'm able to articulate this philosophy of teaching in part because I wrote this book, because when I was writing this book, I was struggling with the so what, right? Like here I am, you know, critiquing social constructionist epistemology, and I'm critiquing a lot of the sort of dominant theories of collaboration to emerge out of that epistemology. And I'm talking about the importance of this thing called post-qualitative inquiry that's grown in social sciences. And I'm thinking like, yeah, but people are going to want to read this book, or some of the people are going to want to read this book and actually have a roadmap or guidelines or suggestions for how to co-author better or how to experiment with collaboration in more kind of creative and rhetorically inventive ways. And so, I mean, I do talk about some particular practices, but I really do sort of stress that, I mean, like all writing, like no one process is going to work every time. And I think I say this early in the book, you know, collaborative writers, just like individual writers, have to invent a way to write together each time they sit down to compose, every single time. Because the thing is, our context, the constraints and resistances that we're up against are always changing. And so, you know, just because I am a successful collaborative writer with my friend John doesn't mean that I can just easily step into another co-authoring ecology with two people I don't know that well and just sort of, you know, jump into it. Everything that I've learned about collaboration with John might not be worth a damn in that context. And so I think that, like, I mean, if anything, I'm really stressing and trying to invite people to experiment with the messiness and not view that messiness as a constraint, but sort of lean into it.
Yeah, I definitely like that. I think maybe students who, or maybe even other people who just like want there to be an easy solution to things. Yeah. It's like a,
right,
darn it, like I want, well, there to, I need to get this done, or like. Well,
and that's something that I think is actually, I mean, I'm glad you pointed out, because I mean, for people that want that sort of procedural guidance, and I think I used the example of in TechCom, collaborative writing is quite normal, especially in like post-secondary classrooms. I mean, if you're majoring in professional writing, I mean, you're used to, you know, quote unquote group work or like team papers or whatever. It's very common. But when you look at the educational resources available, especially textbooks, collaboration in a lot of those conversations is a euphemism for project management. And so, you know, when you're reading like this idea of like, you know, if you're reading a chapter in a textbook on, you know, and it's, the chapter is called collaborative writing, what it's really about is the importance of like making a schedule and deciding on procedures for staying in touch and deciding who's going to be in charge of what. And all of that stuff is certainly important, but that doesn't actually tell us how to write with other people. And I think there's a reason why, because at the end of the day, if we're being honest, we can't teach people how to write with others any more than we can teach someone to write by themselves. You know, Stephen King famously said that, you know, you become a writer by just reading a lot and writing a lot. And that sort of is what I tell my students. You know, I can tell you what works for me, but at the end of the day, the only thing that's going to make you a better writer is just to start doing it and do it a lot. And it's the same thing if you're experimenting with collaboration. You know, I can't tell you a method that's going to work, but I can give you the space to experiment and to take risk and to sort of pursue those little nuggets of text and ideas that are the product of, you know, more than one mind coming together. And I'm glad you pointed that out, because I think that's really important, that even though there are resources available that, you know, supposedly teach students how to collaborate, what they're really just teaching is project management.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And too, maybe some of that like project management or sort of like the collaborative planning stages can sort of maybe like too proceduralize the process, and you can just sort of get lost in the calendar invites rather than actually doing the writing. Something I feel like I also took away maybe in terms of like two advices that you give is like, one is like slowing down the writing process and like making, but like in so doing, you're like making it more like observable, like you're watching the practice. And then sort of alongside that, you say like to like be able to trace it or sort of like document alongside or even within the writing itself, like how things have changed or like what works and what doesn't.
Yeah. That's, you're speaking to sort of, I mean, I try to do early in the book is kind of point out that like why a lot of people are resistant to collaborative writing are the exact reasons or sort of speak to what are its most important resources. One of them being that collaborative writing it slows down the writing process, right? And in that slowdown, it makes our writing more observable. You know, if anyone listening has tried to co-author before, you know that, you know, that process of like, you know, sharing an initial draft or you're sharing a single draft, like let's say in Google Drive, or you're sending your co-author like a Word, you know, like it's incredibly anxiety inducing, especially if this is your first or second time or whatever. And in part because, like, again, when you're just producing these drafts by yourself, you know, the fact that these are drafts don't register in the same ways as they do when you're sharing this early writing with someone else. And so in that way, again, it slows down the writing process. And so you suddenly realize it's like, oh, my partner is really good at editing on the fly. I can't do that. Does that make me like, am I like dragging this collaboration down? I mean, you know, again, like it's in that slowdown where we start to sort of doubt ourselves and get frustrated with the process. But yeah. And so one of the remedies to that, I think is what I call the practice, you know, I gave it a name because you have to name things. I called it parallel composition, but it's this practice that I started with my friend John, and I've kind of been, you know, when I work with grad students who are co-authoring or something, I always sort of recommend you do this, but it's based on this idea from Latour's actor network theory called sort of writing down risky accounts. When essentially I just encourage co-authors to open, just to create a shared document where you literally just, whenever, you know, the spirit moves you, so to speak, you go in there and you just make some notations of what you're thinking about, what you're feeling, what this writing session was just like, what questions you have. And sort of what makes this parallel composition risky is that, one, you're undertaking this as you're writing the other thing. So it's not a process narrative that you compose afterwards. It's not something for anyone else either. This is not, you know, you're not going to go on and publish this risky account. And the third thing is that it has no purpose or preconceived end. You don't know if anything you're noting is going to be useful. But one of the things that Latour says when he explains the value of risky accounts is that the moment you write something down, it gains materiality. It becomes an object that you can then go and engage with as an object, which sort of in the language of this book means that once something is sort of objectified in that way, it can start resisting our own intentions. And that, I think, is really, really important for the theory of collaborative writing that I outline in this book. And so, yeah, so I mean, and I would, you know, I wager that most people, if you think like this is extra work, it's no more extra work than what you're already doing if you're going to co-author something. Just having a document open where you're both just going in and making, just asking questions, or not even going back and answering, you're just literally keeping a registry of everything that is slowing you down or questions you have, so that if you want to at some point, you can then go back with your co-author and look at this registry and try and think about, do any of these kind of objective resistances, did any of them really have a material impact on the outcome? Or can we use this list to help sort of name the method we used to compose? Or can we use this list of objections to kind of help explain or justify to, let's say, a tenure and promotion committee why, no, I'm not going to highlight the parts that I wrote, right? Like that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that. I've definitely felt like that vulnerability in sharing drafts. Like it's very like almost scary to like really put yourself out there and be like, oh no, these are my words. Oh no. That kind of made me think of how like open peer review has like sort of changed what people say in their critiques too. Cause it's like, it's in the open. You can't just like hide behind something. Like your words are sort of out there. But I think if anything, like those, and I think that could be a topic of like, what's the role in making these processes transparent? I think two of the examples, like collaborative futures and like writing the unreadable text.
Yes.
Those sound like maybe you could describe what those are briefly, but to me, those sound like almost like a House of Leaves style insanity, mm-hmm. but like really interesting like conversations about like the text alongside the product itself. Yeah. And so that just sounds really like an interesting thing to share these like risky accounts.
Spend some time engaging with. Even if they're maybe not supposed to
be
shared,
but like that they could be.
Yeah. Yeah. So as you mentioned, so these two texts that I engage with in the book, one of them is a book called Collaborative Futures. And the other one is an article, a collaboratively written article. It's a collaborative autoethnography that was published in the online journal Hybrid Pedagogy a number of years ago. And I look at both of those texts because they both kind of turn themselves inside out as collaborative texts. That first one, the book Collaborative Futures was produced in a writing sprint, I think, and I'm not going to, I forget the details, but there was a group of, I think, six or seven writers, and there was a coder, I think, and like a team leader, and they hold up, I think, at the first version, I think they were in Germany for maybe like 72 hours or something, and their entire goal was to write a book about collaboration that kind of pushed back. Its emphasis was to sort of push back against sort of the ways that Web 2.0 had invited people to sort of nominally embrace the open web and Web 2.0 tools and ways of sort of, again, like creating a more open, democratic sort of global society. When what they wanted to point out was, you know, like the groups that were sort of most notorious for their collaborations, like that, like the hacker group Anonymous, right? Like, they actually like are really bad models of collaboration because their processes are hidden. They don't want the agency of the collaboration to have any sort of history. And so I look at these texts as examples of ways that, so as I said earlier, you know, when you have this, if you maintain a risky account or of parallel composition, you know, the only audience is yourself and your co-authors or whatever. Like there's no public for it really. But what these two texts do and their authors is they kind of, I mean, they don't use these terms, of course, but they kind of take these risky accounts that they have been maintaining and sort of weave them into the published public versions of their text, which make these documents, I should have said this originally, if you go and look at either of these documents, they are weird. They are weird texts. And I mean that in the most generous and like exciting way I can. You know, like initially, like I was turned off by them in part because I just didn't understand them. Like why, you know, why is this group of educators who publish this article on hybrid pedagogy, why are they linking to a Google Doc that was the first version of the article that they never finished? And why are they like why are they making this private writing public? I had a lot of trouble understanding that until I really started to kind of embrace the idea that, you know, that collaborative writers should be the ones who get to name and qualify what that work entails for themselves. And so I hold up those two texts as just sort of models for how different kinds of teams of writers can be deliberate about not just writing together, but also really taking ownership of those processes and naming those processes.
Mm-hmm. I know, like in the unreadable text one, you said that there's like over like 100 marginal comments. And yeah. I can also anticipate, or I would imagine that trying to even parse through them, if you're not like aware of the context, like it just probably just makes no sense.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. It does make no sense, which again sort of goes against, you know, the idea of why, like of publishing to begin with, right? Like, you know, you're always told to keep the audience in mind. And so mm-hmm. what's happening in these texts that there is, you know, that part of these texts are literally unreadable in that sort mm-hmm. of scholarly sense of reading that a lot of us associate with writing, right? Which is that like the audience gets to understand that, you know, there's a clarity there that's accessible. And it's and I would argue that, you know, like writing the unreadable untext, like I would say that there is a clarity there for an audience to sort of engage with, but it's not one that is inviting in the sense that there's going to be that, like, you're not going to have any trouble making sense of what's going on there. It is going to sort of ruffle your affective feathers, so to speak.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, it's always about like the process and experience of the thing. But that it also sounds like that would go back to like each collaboration is different. And like a different group of authors writing the on text piece would be a totally different experience and a very different book.
Absolutely.
But sort of going back to the risky accounts thing, I liked what you said about like sort of turning that into, or like maybe it doesn't seem like apparent, like useful, like as you're doing it, like making these risky accounts, but then like you can turn it into something else. Like you said, like, oh, you could analyze it and be like, oh, this is why we should get funding, or like, this is why we should publish in this other way. Mm-hmm. That kind of makes me wonder if and how, like at an institutional level, like what would be sort of like required to sort of change that like academic economy into, and like sort of have it buy into or value that like process-based collaboration, mm-hmm. instead of having everything be so like hierarchical or metricized.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's a really good question. And if I, you know, if I had a clear answer and a plan, I would be out, you know, knocking down doors right now with it to see these changes enacted. I think there are two things that matter. One is normalizing collaborative writing in ways that it just really isn't yet in higher education. And I mean that not only on the pedagogy side, the way that we teach, but also in the ways that we kind of conduct the business side of collaboration as academics. I think early in the book, I talk about how I use terms, but like right now, for example, I'm conflating co-authorship and collaborative writing. When really, right, like when you have a group of, you know, I mentioned this in the book, when you have like 500 biologists contributing to an article and they're all listed as co-authors, right? Like that, the idea of co-authorship there means something very different than like collaborative writing in that, you know, like romantic social constructionist sense of a, you know, a community coming together. Because, you know, the politics of co-authorship is very much about, you know, it's wrapped up into the politics of citation practices and, you know, funding and that kind of stuff. But I would say that like, again, the first thing is just normalizing collaborative writing as a practice. And so, you know, as someone who teaches writing, for example, I mean, I'm at the point now when I don't want to necessarily say I teach collaborative writing in every class, but I do absolutely incorporate it and I make it an option for everything students write. So, you know, if for some strange reason, like a high school student is listening to this podcast and they're going to enroll in a first year writing class I teach, you should know that you're going to have the option to co-author everything in that class if you want to. Now, here's the thing. Students don't. That's never happened because, again, collaborative writing is not a normalized practice. High school students, middle school students are not invited to co-author. I mean, I have a 7-year-old and a 4-year-old, and I think about 7 is when collaboration goes out the window in writing. You know, in preschool, yeah, you sit down and you write stories together, right? Exactly. It's scarecrows. But that goes out the door early in our sort of formal education. And so I think one of the first things we just need to do is just, again, it doesn't mean creating, you don't have to be an expert. You don't have to necessarily teach it. It's just creating the space and opportunity for students to co-author. That's the first thing you have to do. And then I think the second thing is, if you do embrace collaborative writing in your own work, you should strive to contribute to what in the book I call sort of minor literatures of collaboration, which is sort of taking, like not necessarily taking those risky accounts, but sort of, you know, if you have a co-author, for example, that you often write with, why not, you know, spend a couple of months producing a, to use this term, a weird text that really sort of explores your writing process and tries to tease out something useful or interesting for other people interested in co-authorship, because there are lots of venues where you can publish these things, right? And so, you know, when I was going up for tenure and promotion in my department, and I should say in my own department, my colleagues have a very generous attitude towards collaboration, even though we are a very traditional English department in a lot of ways. But I mean, it was kind of hard, you know, because so much of my work focused on collaborative writing theory, it was kind of impossible for anyone to question the value of right co-authorship that I was doing, right? Because it's, I mean, to do so would be going against the very arguments that I, you know, have published about. And so I think, again, it just comes down to if you do have the space to write about the work of your co-authorship with someone, you know, there are avenues for making that public, even if it's not public in like a peer-reviewed sense, but just making that work public. Because I think one of the reasons why collaborative writing isn't normalized is for these reasons we talked about earlier, which is the only discussion of it as a kind of work is in terms of, you know, process or in terms of project management. We rarely get to see how the sausage is made, so to speak, with real collaborative writers. And so to make some of that work public, I think is how you sort of start to, if you're not changing the norms, you're at least trying to make those practices a little bit less mysterious.
Yeah. I feel like I've been thinking about, like, I think it's Ivan Illich has like the idea of shadow work.
Yes.
On how absolutely. Like there's just so many things that you just don't see that go into like whatever the final draft or the final book. But I do wonder, and maybe it's a little cynical, but I wonder if making those things public in any sense, like be it a traditional publication or even a blog form, if those things could then just become like commodified as well. And like it's sort of wrapped into like the academic economy of like, oh, that counts as a publication. So that's another numbers game.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it is. But again, I think this is where I am, you know, this book owes a lot to New Materialist ontology and philosophy. And I think that we can look to those traditions to sort of to see how some of those writers and scholars are kind of turning those philosophies into actual practices that trouble some of those norms. And so, for example, I have a colleague at the University of Memphis who teaches in the educational philosophy. She teaches in the School of Education. But I mentioned this in one of the footnotes of a book. She is a post-qualitative theorist and has developed she's developed a couple of methods for doing kind of interview work that kind of troubles a lot of the positivist associations that get circulated in qualitative inquiry. And in one of these pieces, she talks about the role of her animal companions as these sources of agency for her writing. In fact, in Rhetoric and Composition, there's a scholar who just recently published a book called Acknowledging Writing Partners. Her name is Laura Michici. I hope I pronounced her last name correctly. But, you know, it's a book about acknowledge, you know, book acknowledgements and how so often it's, you know, things like pets or landscapes or pieces of furniture or cups of coffee, you know, in a way sort of almost humorously get acknowledged. But when you see the ways that these things are proliferated and acknowledged, once you realize they actually have a material effect on the writing. But, you know, to get back to this example, my colleague ended up using her cats, her animal, these two cats. She listed them as co-authors on this article, and it was published, right? It's literally like, you know, these two cat names and her last name and then her name. And if you look up this article in scholarly databases, these three authors come up. And it's not unless you read the article that you realize that two of these authors are cats. And what actually ended up happening was Fox News got a hold of this article, and there was a segment on it in which, you know, of course, these hosts just, you know, it was the traditional sort of, this is what your tax dollars is going to. How silly is this? Mm-hmm. But again, like in the context of this conversation, I love how this writer really sort of leaned into the topic of her inquiry in a way that deliberately disrupted some of these normalized practices of citation. I mean, yeah, you could certainly some people might write it off as strictly performative or whatever. That's fine, you know, but again, the fact that, you know, it slows us down, to go back to this earlier theme, that the fact that I have to stop and like think, oh, that's interesting and odd and weird that these cats are listed as co-authors. But again, it's in that slowdown, it's in that pause where that work of change and that reorientation starts to do its work. Slowly, but it's doing its work.
Mm-hmm. I really like that example. I don't think I have heard of it. It's really, really cute to think of. And it's like so important that like there's so many things beyond like just writing or beyond like the two, three people who are
right,
the collaborators that yes. are like play a role. Like it also makes me like it's the coffee or it's the cats or it's like Google Docs or yes. it's like the weather outside that it's all impacting. Yes. But I guess my little bait for Google Docs, it makes me sort of like I think you introduced like the concept of like triangulation, I think, where it's mm-hmm. like you have like the authors, but also like they end up interacting with
yes.
like the objects of discourse and how like these things sort of like take on a thing of their own. Mm-hmm. And I also, that makes me wonder like what you think sort of like what those, like the autonomy agency of those objects are. And then also just sort of like, how to create like either like a digital or like a workspace, like how that sort of yeah. influences that whole like ecosystem and process.
Yeah. I mean, those are good questions. And those are the questions that I really wrestled with when I was writing this book, because, you know, as I said earlier, I wanted readers to have some sort of practices or concepts that were clear enough that they could then go and do something with them. While at the same time, I wanted to underscore that all of our practices are arbitrary, you know, until they're not, and vice versa. And so, you know, when it comes to like Google Docs, for example, like that's just to me, like, and to like my friend John that I write with all the time, that's just an easy space for us to get our work done. But certainly it's not, you know, I would never, you know, I'm not someone who's going to go on Twitter and like argue why this platform is better than this other one or what have you. That idea of triangulation is important, because that's actually where, for me, when I'm writing with someone else, what I'm looking for, what I'm anticipating, is that moment when this document that we're co-producing, it usually is a moment that I can actually kind of, at this point, I can kind of stop and like notice. It's that moment when suddenly it's no longer my pieces and my writing partner's pieces. It's now this third kind of thing that, you know, it's, I mean, it's, it's, again, it's this object that now exists unto itself, that, you know, the ideas and intentions that I had for it, now this shared object is kind of functionally saying, I don't want to be that anymore, right? And it's saying that in a way that for me, it's saying, well, you know, I don't want to have to go back, like start from scratch. I'm interested in where this text is going. And again, it's in that moment where I might be able to go and like point to ideas or lines or paragraphs that were originally mine, but in that ecosystem of that Google Doc, combined with the pieces that my writing partner has contributed, combined with how we're now making sense of those, like all you know, all of a sudden, you know, this writing that might have at one point been mine, quote unquote, again, it's now this third space. It's now exists in this third space. It's this object that I don't control in the same ways. And for me, that's the most exciting moment in a collaborative writing project, because that's when I know that this thing that's growing, like, this is why I choose to co-author. It's to discover ideas I didn't know I had, which is even that's not even a good way of describing it, right? It's discovering ideas that I didn't know were possible, that were ideas I could think until they presented themselves to me. And to get to your question about like the agency of these things, this is where I think, you know, keeping a risky account is so important, because, you know, at the end of the day, it's up to the collaborators to decide what the agency is of this document. You know, I talk about an emerging text as this agentic object that has agency, right? But I don't want to, you know, I don't want anyone to be confused here in the sense that I think that we could talk about it in sort of objective ways. Again, it's why I think somewhere else in the book I say that for co-authors who are unwilling to sort of own and account for their processes, there are tons of people outside of that collaboration who are more than happy to account for it, who are more than happy to say, oh, well, your name's first, so you're more important. That's how we're going to account for that work. Or, you know, this is a grad student, and so obviously since you're writing with a senior scholar, even, the, you know, we're just going to assume the grad student was less important than the senior scholar, right? Like, there are tons of people outside of a collaboration who are more than willing to own the processes that you experienced in composing a document. And so, you know, when we talk about the agency of a text or keeping a risky account, like, essentially what I'm saying is that, just own it. Just why don't you take charge as co-authors and say, this is what I think, this is why I think this text is better than some of its parts. Here is why these processes shouldn't be atomized into their, you know, like singular points of origin. Which is not to say that there aren't collaborative texts that we can do that. I recently helped write a book chapter where I think there were like 8 or 9 co-authors. And it was a process that was very linear, that, you know, I can point to the sections of text that I quote unquote wrote. That doesn't minimize any of my arguments, I think, about the value of co-authorship. Just because some texts can be composed in that sort of ad hoc, you know, like we're going to push these pieces together, right? Like, sure, of course, so some texts can, but again, like typically the more conventional or procedure oriented the text itself, the easier it is to write that way, right? Which is why sort of if you're writing, let's say, maybe a grant application, you know, like co-authoring a grant application for experienced scholars is not that difficult, because again, the process is so generic, you know, and when you have a generic process, it's easier to manipulate those generic, you know, points and levers, I would say. But again, like when you're writing, you know, when you go to a conference and you meet some person who's into the same thing, and you go and you have coffee afterwards and you start talking about your shared interest and, oh my gosh, like we should write about this or whatever. Like, okay, well, you know, all of us have those moments, but there's not a generic procedure available for taking those interests and combining them in ways that just are going to automatically result in a collaborative text. So.
Yeah, I would definitely note that maybe grant writing because it is inherently procedural. Let's not make it not arduous.
No, that's right. Yes.
Easy it's, in one yeah. way.
Yeah. It definitely arduous. It's also why I write so few. I apply for so few grants because the writing is so boring, I think, in a lot of ways. But
yeah, it's definitely not creative or collaborative or experimental.
I don't want to. I don't want to anger anyone who really loves grant writing. So
there's an art to it. But I liked what you said about like going sort of beyond owning. And I think you have a quote that's like, or I remember reading this, it was like go beyond owning and instead like owning up to like your responsibilities and like what is like answerability to what it is. Mm-hmm. And I guess that maybe ties back. I feel like, or something that you said earlier about like, oh, if you think you're going to have like this good collaboration, like maybe the first thing that you do is like write that weird thing. Like you make that risky account when you make a new collaboration just to like iron everything out.
Yep. Yeah. And again, I said, I think this is where I am interested in. I mean, I love talking to other people who co-author because I really am interested in that shadow work and that chat, in that minor labor, if you want to call it that. Because again, like there's, when my friend, John Pell and I have been writing together since graduate school. And so, we don't like, I'm not as deliberate with our collaborative writing projects because there's such an intimacy and a long history of work there that really you're just sort of jumping back into the same pool. But I do think, when you're undertaking a new project with someone you haven't written with, I do think there's immense value in just slowing down up front and just talking about what potential value there would be in just tracking the processes of that work together, if for nothing else, so that down the road, if this does become, if you are a pre-tenure or contingent faculty or something like that, but like if for nothing else, it's a way, something for you to come back to. And, again, it's a rhetorical resource of sorts that you can leverage to sort of promote your work, to promote its value, not despite the fact that it was co-authored, but because of it. And again, I'm also just like, I teach, right? Like I love, I'm the person who goes and like anytime a writer that I love writes a book about writing, I know it's kind of cliche, right? Like we have so many books about writing, but I love thinking metacritically about writing. So anytime, I have a colleague who writes a blog post about the writing process, or anytime, I come back to Stephen King's memoir on writing all of the time. I'm not really a big Stephen King reader, right? But I love that memoir so much. I'm almost, again, in a lot of ways, I'm more interested in the processes that go into the work that people do than the work itself, which is odd to say in the sense that I'm a professor. But, I joke with students, with my grad students, say I'm not really a researcher. I just like to write about the work of research, which is sort of, I don't know if I use that as a crutch or what, but here I am.
I guess it makes me curious, like where is like scholarly communications taking collaborative writing? Like what sort of directions are collaborations going in?
Yeah, here's the thing, right? Like the fact of the matter is that it is now the norm in higher education. Like co-authorship is the norm. And even in disciplines that historically have been dominated by single authorship, it's becoming increasingly more difficult to have draconian policies that sort of punish people for collaborating. And there's lots of reasons for this. If you're in the social sciences or the physical sciences, it just takes so many resources to conduct research, that like you can't not co-author, so to speak. The technologies we have available make it increasingly easier, not necessarily easier in that sense of ease of use, right? But easier in the sense that there are more resources that you can leverage to do the work itself. As far as where, you know, in terms of scholarly communication, where it's going, I don't know, but I do think there's like, we're going to have some hard conversations about attribution, about mm-hmm. reward, because especially in the humanities, I think, where increasingly there are people who want to co-author, but they don't necessarily have the language or the models available to them. And so if anything, I hope more people will aspire to contribute to this emerging language that can be adapted to navigate this work. Oh, and I hope that they will contribute to producing models that can be studied and referenced as resources that promote collaborative writing.
Yeah. So maybe as a note, I know at least in like a lot of the physical sciences, there's this thing called like ORCID that you can like tie your name to and like attribute the different things that you do. And that seems like a, maybe, I don't know if it's if you think it's useful too, but I think it's kind of interesting to sort of like, not that labeling, I think labeling can fall into that sort of system of gamifying it, but it does seem like a way to, or like a stepping stone to having those type of attributions.
No, absolutely. And I think that there, mm-hmm. you know, it's actually in some of the physical sciences, especially in some of the journals that follow the American Medical Association's style guide, they have, over the last 5 or 10 years, many of them have been adopting editorial policies that explicitly require their articles to include some sort of qualitative statement of attribution. Which, you know, it might be generic, right? Like, again, with any time you try to standardize something, you invite, you know, generic practices, right? And so, but I mean, again, like in and of itself, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I mean, to be able to say that there's 15 people who contributed to this research study and to say that, you know, authors 1, 2, and 3 helped design the study, authors 4, 5, and 6 helped process the results, authors 7 and 8 wrote the draft. Like, I mean, I think all of that is certainly useful, especially in, let's say, some of these fields where scholarly work manifests in really important but different kinds of roles. I think that's absolutely important. Again, I think as someone who comes from and teaches in the humanities, I think that like this is where I think I'm most interested in seeing some of this change work happen, because I mean we have been since the 60s our theorists have been telling us that the single isolated author is a fiction, but in practice we've just been running full steam ahead with that myth, and so you know again like it's. When, for example, like if you have two historians coming together to write, I mean, it's not a matter of who designs the research project and who processes the results. I mean, in that kind of work, it's about, you know, how do you combine your, you know, different years of experience and perspectives and kind of harness them in ways that are inventive and productive of ideas and insights that it's not that you couldn't have had by yourself, but you're having now because they're, you know, embedded with and producing sort of a new habitus, you know, with which to view your subject of inquiry. Again, it's not easy to talk about that. There is no magic formula for doing that. You just do it. And so, you know, it's like, again, like it's like all those mentors out there telling their grad students to just put their ass in the chair and write, because at the end of the day, if you just get words on the page, something is going to happen. Something organic is going to happen. It's the same way, you know? But again, when you write together, it's more risky, especially if you don't have models, especially if you aren't guaranteed that labor is going to be recognized in ways that maybe it would be if you were writing by yourself. So I guess that's where I find myself. And that's where that your your earlier question about the future of collaboration in some of these discussions. I don't know, but I know this is where I would like to see it happen. I like to see more sort of humanist and people who do sort of write less qualitative research. I would like to see them sort of stepping up and really exploring and promoting the work of collaborative writing.
Yeah, I love that. I'd hope to see that. I hope to see that too. Mm-hmm. So maybe as a final question, what can readers expect from you next?
Oh gosh. My friend John and I are in the early stages of what I think we are anticipating to be a book project about sort of the politics of civility in public debate. Mm-hmm. We're sort of interested in getting at those discussions through a new materialist lens. We're starting that. And and then right now I just finished a project with another friend of mine, Jacob Babb, it's a book chapter that focuses on the ways that teachers of writing sort of respond to kind of public critics of composition. Sort of it's mm-hmm. Whenever you see a piece in the Chronicle of Higher Education or Inside Higher Ed about how we're teaching students writing all wrong, we just finished an article about this kind of like, how do we sort of productively engage with those arguments? So that's what I'm working on right now, and we'll see what happens.
That's cool. Yeah, I don't want to push or make you speed up the process, right? I mean, keep it slow and steady. But thank you for meeting with me and having this great discussion.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it. I appreciate all of your really good questions.
Yeah, thank you, and have a good semester as well.
Thanks.